That should be recording, I think. Doesn't seem to be. Yes, it is here. So we conclude now from chapter 28 to 39 in half an hour. So it's going to be a bit. Isaiah chapter 28, verses 1 to 4, looks back to the build-up to the destruction of Samaria, which was 721, the destruction of the northern kingdom. Remember, Isaiah started his preaching in about 740, something like that, and he goes through to about 700. So this is halfway through his career, and the north is so. Isaiah recalls what happened to Samaria, which he calls Ephraim. It was besieged by Shalmaneser. Find that in 2 Kings 17, and it fell to Sargon II in 721 BC. Judah's behaviour is even worse, so it must expect a similar fate. The text, the proud garland of the drunkards of Ephraim, and the fading flower of its glorious beauty, which is on the head of those bloated with rich food, those overcome with wine. See, the Lord has, brackets, in reserve, the Lord has one who is mighty and strong. Like a storm of hail, a destroying tempest, like a storm of mighty overflowing waters, with his hand he'll hurl them down to the earth. Trampled underfoot will be the proud garland of the drunkards of Ephraim and the fading flower of its glorious beauty, which is on the head of those bloated with rich food, be like the first ripe fig before the summer. Whoever eats it up as soon as it comes to hand. Now verses 5 to 6, I suggest a later editor interrupts with the following reflection. Their true garland is Yahweh. Those who survive the Holocaust, the Shoah, will enjoy communion with Yahweh and with those who live justly. And often I think a literary hint that we're dealing with later is on that day. On that day, Yahweh of hosts will be a garland of glory and a diadem of beauty to the remnant of his people, and a spirit of justice to the one who sits in judgment, and strength to those who turn back the battle at the gate. And with that pious relief, which is beautiful, we come back to the text, verse 7. The priests and the prophets are no better than the drunken horde, drunken lot in the court of Samaria. These also reel with wine and stagger with strong drink. The priest and the prophet reel with strong drink. They should be reeling with the Spirit of God, but the Spirit of God is Glenfiddich. The priest and the prophet reel with strong drink. They are confused with wine, stagger with strong drink. They err in vision and they stumble in giving judgment. All tables are covered with filthy vomit. No place is clean. He's not mucking around. Whom will he teach knowledge, and to whom will he explain the message? Those who are weaned from milk, those taken from the breast? For it is, and then he says, Shol Ashur, Shol Ashur, Keu Lakeu, Keu Lakeu, Z'er Sham, Z'er Sham. That's what he says in Hebrew. It's translated precept upon precept, precept, line upon line, line upon line, here a little, here a little. What it really means is abracadabra, blah, blah, blah. They're up in the pulpit giving us all this academic, abstract stuff that's got no relationship to us sitting in the pews, and they're gabbling away with all this stuff, and they're producing documents that are going nowhere, and it's all like la-di-da-di-da-di-da, and they're not in touch. That's what he's saying. La-di-da-di-da-di-da would be a reasonable translation of the Hebrew. But it'll come back again. This is all they're saying. Don't even try to translate it. It's gibberish. and giving legitimation to the policies favoured by the court. Truly, he goes on, with stammering lip and alien tongue, he will speak to his people to whom he has said, "This is rest, give rest to the weary, this is repose," yet they wouldn't hear. Therefore, God's word to them will be, "Shor la shor, shor la shor, keu la keu, keu la keu, tse'er sham, tse'er sham." Blah, 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 blah. In order that they may go and fall backward and be broken and snared and taken. So they're getting no help from the prophets. They're getting no help from the priests. You couldn't say that today, of course. The Jerusalem leadership isn't listening. Therefore, hear the word of Yahweh, you scoffers who rule this people in Jerusalem. Now he's come back home. Because you've said we've made a covenant with death, and with Sheol we have an agreement. Death, Sheol, what's he talking about there? Likely the alliance with Egypt, Osiris, the god of death, and necromancy, the god Mort, the local god. So things are grim, they're worried about things, and they're reverting back, as people still do, sadly, as we probably would there, but the grace of God go I, Philip Nero, was it? We do this too. When you get a group of people, we can behave, revert in fear to our worst part of us. So you get the Austria, you know, German Hitler comes into Austria and everybody cheers. They're all Catholics, by the way, 90% something Catholic. And they're as happy as Larry that Hitler's come in. And the Austrians, so they say, and there might be something in this, I've lived in Germany for a little while, and the German people are so full of repentance for what happened under Hitler. Like, it's a shame on them, and it led to such, and it's not all good, but it's a terrific amount of good. You know, the Caritas and this care for missions, and Germany really repented of Hitler, and it's they're almost too ashamed of it still 50 years later. Austria never got to that, and they said that Germany really came in, and they were the first victims of Germany. You know, which, like the, what they've forgotten the word? Anschluss, that's it. The opening, the welcome, really. Well, they came in and Austria seems to have, well, they certainly welcomed. You've got to look at the footage, everybody. And the proportion of Austrians who were in the SS and the proportion of Austrians who were in Auschwitz doing all the dirty jobs is way above the proportion of Austrians in the German Reich. So there's something about Austria that didn't get to it till quite late. Hopefully they have now, and I'm not here to criticise Austria. It's just that, anyway, I suppose I am criticising Austria. I didn't really mean to get onto that. I don't even know why I did. Chapter 28, verse 15. When the overwhelming scourge passes through, it will not come to us, for we've made lies our refuge, and in falsehood we have taken shelter. The Jerusalem leadership is not listening to what's going on. Verse 16 to 17, therefore thus says the Lord Yahweh, see, I am laying in Zion a stone, a massive stone, a precious cornerstone, a sure foundation. One who trusts will not waver, and I will make justice the measuring line and righteousness the plumb line. There's going to be, God's going to put someone in this city who's going to be a force to be reckoned with by the leaders, the priests, the prophets, the populace. And you can see why that quote, can you, is often used in the New Testament of Jesus, who stood up against law and state and church and everybody with his love, and was you get crushed by him if you don't listen, and he is the cornerstone for building a new temple. Chapter 28, verse 17, hail will sweep away the refuge of lies, waters will overwhelm the shelter. Then your covenant with death will be annulled, says Isaiah to his contemporary leaders in Jerusalem, "Your agreement with Sheol will not stand. When the overwhelming scourge passes through, you will be beaten down by it." So he's looking at what's happening. He can see what's going to happen if they keep going and they're not listening. So he's just letting them know what the future holds if they don't wake up. "For Yahweh will rise up as on Mount Perazim. He will rage as in the valley of Gibeon." References go back to the story of David in 2 Samuel and to the story of Joshua. "To do his deed, strange is his deed, and to work his work, alien is his work. Now therefore do not scoff, or your bonds will be made stronger. For I have heard a decree of destruction from the Lord Yahweh of hosts upon the whole land." What's happened up there is going to happen here. If, there's always an if in prophecy, if we don't listen. Then the next few verses continue the theme, which I won't read to you, and we come now to chapter 29, which looks like it's about the siege. At the end of his career, goes right back to chapter 1, really, of Isaiah, of the introductory chapter. "Ah," he says, "Ariel, Ariel, the city where David encamped, add year to year. Yet I will distress Ariel, and there shall be moaning and lamentation, and Jerusalem shall be to me like Ariel." The scholars play with that. Thank you. The scholars play with that, and I'll give you all the information I know about it. The name Ariel has a number of references. Ari means lion in Hebrew, and El means God. So Ariel, lion of God, lion of Judah. So he's talking about the city and its emblem, its escutcheon, perhaps. So he's actually talking about, he's using it as a name for Jerusalem. That's one possibility. Another scholar suggests the sound is close to the sound ir, ari, ir, el, city of God. Could be a play on the similarity of sound. And the third bit of evidence is that Ezekiel in chapter 43, verse 15, talking about the altar of sacrifice, calls the table of the altar Ariel. Now, how you put all that together, your guess is going to be nearly as good as mine. Is he saying Jerusalem shall be to me like an Ariel? Is he saying it will be a place of slaughter? It'll be like an altar on which the animal is slaughtered. So they're the kind of literary nuances in this rather strange term, Ariel, to be using. But it's clearly got something to do with Jerusalem, and it's probably got something to do with the altar, the sacrifice, and it's continuing. Sadly, it's, "I will distress Ariel, and there'll be moaning and lamentation." There's going to be destruction to this city. Continue the text. "Like David, I will encamp against you." Do you remember how David was the one who captured the city of Jerusalem and from the Jebusites? It was the last big city to fall. It was quite strong and well-walled, and he tricked them and came in through the water tower and whatever. And that's the story you can find in the book of Samuel. And then he, having captured the city, made it the centre for his north-south united kingdom, as the story unfolds. "I will besiege you with towers and raise siege works against you." He's threatening. He can see that Jerusalem is going to go the way of Samaria because its behaviour is no different. Isaiah 29 verses 5 to 8 talks about the siege being miraculously lifted. You can read that for yourself. There's nothing significant in that I want to dwell on. Then the remaining chapters there, chapter 29, 9 to 14, continue to talk about the people being unwilling to listen, unwilling to see. And I'll just quote little bits of that. Chapter 29 verse 10, "Yahweh has poured out upon you a spirit of deep sleep. He has closed your eyes, you prophets, and covered your heads, you seers." You probably recall chapter 6 of Isaiah, go to the people and they won't listen. Speak to them and they won't hear. Remember that? And it goes, because they had this idea that everything happens is somehow organised by God, the people didn't listen, so God must have willed them not to listen. That's the theology, in order to get them right down to the ground and then punish them so they'll really repent. So here it is here. God has closed your eyes, your prophets. That's their theology. And he has covered your head so you can't see into the heavens and see God's will. He's blinkered you. Verses 13 to 14, Yahweh said, because these people draw near with their mouths and honour me with their lips, while their hearts are far from me, their worship of me is a human commandment learned by rote. And if you look up Mark chapter 7, you see Jesus quoting that to his contemporaries. Because these people draw near with their mouth and honour me with their lips, their hearts are far from me. The worship of me is a human commandment learned by rote. Quoted, as I said there, in Mark, and you can look up Colossians as well, chapter 2. So I will again do amazing things with this people, shocking and amazing. The wisdom of the wise will perish. The discernment of the discerning shall be hidden. Another text quoted by 1 Corinthians 1:19 when he's talking about the wisdom of the world and the community is so unwise and they're all bragging about their wisdom and they're fighting like anything among each other. I'm from Apollos, I'm for Paul, I'm for Cephas. And Paul comes back and says, well, I'm for Christ, so I don't know what you lot are on about. And he finds that text quotable. Here's a text, chapter 29, verse 15, and the following. The limits of political wisdom, know-how. Ha, he says, you who hide a plan too deep for Yahweh, whose deeds are in the dark, who say, who sees, who knows us? You turn things upside down. Shall the potter be regarded as the clay? Shall the things made say of its maker, he didn't make us? Or the thing formed say of the one who formed it, he has no understanding? Reference to Romans 9:30, who quotes that. Shall not Lebanon in a very little while become a fruitful field, and the fruitful field be as common as forest? On that day the deaf shall hear the words of a scroll, and out of the gloom and darkness the eyes of the blind shall see. On that day, one day, you'll wake up and see. Do it now, he says. The lowly shall obtain fresh joy in Yahweh, and the neediest people shall exult in the Holy One of Israel. For the tyrant shall be no more, the scoffer shall cease to be. All those alert to do evil shall be cut off, those who cause a person to lose a lawsuit, who set a trap for the arbiter in the gate, and without grounds deny justice to the one in the light. So he's back to his favourite topic, the collapse of justice, the cause of all the problems. Chapter 30, the early part is the folly of having an alliance with Egypt. Let you read it. And then, chapter 30, verse 8, Isaiah's warning is to be recorded. Go now, it's one of the early references to the writing. Go now, write it before them on a tablet. Once the thing is written, it's there forever. So it's a sign of importance. And write it before them on a tablet, inscribe it in a book, so that it may be for the time to come as a witness forever. That's why in the story of the Ten Commandments, some of them Moses writes it and some of them God writes it. Depends on what story you read. But on the tablets of stone, so it's forever fixed. For they are a rebellious people, faithless children, children who will not hear the instruction of Yahweh, who say to the seers, don't see, to the prophets, don't prophesy to us what is right, Speak to us smooth things. Prophesy illusions. Leave the way. Turn aside from the path. Let's hear no more about the Holy One of Israel. Let's be practical and get on with real politic and stop all this religious hogwash. That's what they're saying to the prophet. Chapter 30, 15. In turning back and staying still, you shall be saved. Stop what you're doing. Stay there and you'll be saved. In quietness and in trust shall be your strength. But you refused and you said, no, we'll speed upon horses. Horses always means war. Therefore you shall speed in flight. We'll ride upon swift steeds, yes, but your pursuers will be swift. 1,000 shall flee at the threat of one. At the threat of 5 you shall flee until you're left like a flagstaff on the top of a mountain, like a lookout post on a hill. All that's left is the flapping flag and you're all destroyed. Therefore, Yahweh waits to be gracious to you. Therefore, he will rise up to show mercy to you. For Yahweh is a God of justice. Blessed are those who wait for him. So there's a couple of texts there that I would think you'd love to go back to, I imagine. The first two there. In turning back and staying still, you shall be saved. He's not asking them to do a lot, because God's going to do the saving. But don't continue along this dead end that you have heading into. In quietness and in trust shall be your strength. That's for us too, isn't it, often? It's in acceptance of what happens in our life that we find strength and peace. And here, Yahweh is a God of justice. Blessed are those who wait. Wait on grace. Wait for him. Chapter 30, the last verses, I suggest, is a later commentary, and I'll just read it to you. Truly, O people in Zion, inhabitants of Jerusalem, you shall weep no more. He will surely be gracious to you at the sound of your cry. When he hears it, he will answer you. Though the Lord may give you the bread of adversity and the water of affliction, yet your teacher will not hide himself any more, but your eyes shall see your teacher. And when you turn to the right, or when you turn to the left, your ears shall hear a word behind you saying, this is the way, walk in it. Teacher, the Torah. Then you will defile your silver-covered idols and your gold-plated images. You'll scatter them like filthy rags. You'll say to them, away with you, on the day when Yahweh heals the wounds inflicted by his blow. So he's had a lot of heavy stuff, and this is quite lovely. God is only punishing you in order to heal you and to bring you life. Chapter 31 is a short chapter on relying on Yahweh and not on Egypt. Chapter 32 paints a picture of the ideal king and the invasion of 701, easy to read on your own. And chapter 33 is the first part is upon divine judgment. I'll take up again chapter 33, verse 14 to 16. Who can avoid the judgment of God is the topic. The sinners of Zion are afraid. Trembling has seized the godless. Who among us can live with the devouring fire? Who among us can live with everlasting flames? There's different ways of looking at that, but as in the text itself, it's the fire of God's purifying love, but it's purifying and it's going to burn up anything that's dross or not of value. Those who walk righteously, this is the answer, and speak uprightly, who despise the gain of oppression, they can handle this because it won't touch them, who wave away a bribe instead of accepting it, who stop their ears from hearing of bloodshed and shut their eyes from looking on evil, They will live on the heights. Their refuge will be the fortresses of rocks. Their food will be supplied, their water assured. Obviously encouraging them to live a life of justice. Then the chapter ends by describing a future where there's no fear. Chapter 34 to 35. Blenkinsop, who's a scholar in this area, writes this about these two chapters. Chapter 34 and 35 belong together, comprising a recapitulation of the message of the book as understood in eschatological terms by a writer of the later Second Temple period. So it's his conviction that these are quite late parts of the scroll. I have a go at Edom again in chapter 34. Chapter 35 is about the final restoration of Judah. And I'll just read to you the verses 3 to 6, etc. Isaiah 35:3 reads, and I'm doing this partly because it's quoted by the author of the letter to the Hebrews, and you'll recognize other parts of it in the New Testament. Strengthen the weak hands, make firm the feeble knees. Say to those who are of a fearful heart, be strong, don't be afraid. Here is your God. He will come with vengeance, with terrible recompense. He will come and save you. Perhaps you should say awesome recompense. Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened. Jesus, you ready? The ears of the deaf unstopped. The lame will leap like a deer. And the tongue of the speechless sing for joy. I think that's the text where the people come from John the Baptist and say, are you the Messiah or not? And Jesus says, just go and tell John the Baptist what you see and hear. And he quotes this text. Let him work it out for himself, but this is just telling the facts. Verse 6, waters shall break forth in the wilderness and streams in the desert. The burning sand shall become a pool and the thirsty ground springs of water. The haunt of jackals shall become a swamp. The grass shall become reeds and rushes. A highway shall be there, and it will be called the Holy Way, Via Sacra in Latin, the Holy Way. And you will recall probably in Rome, the Via Sacra was the way that led through the Forum up to the Temple of Jupiter. I'm not making a connection there, but the idea of a Via Sacra was pretty common in all religions. Well, here's the similar image here. It's the Holy Way. The unclean shall not travel on it, but it shall be for God's people. No traveller, not even fools, shall go astray if they follow this way. No lion shall be there. And remember, lions were not that far from Jerusalem. Jordan River, that was jungle on both sides, and there were lions in the jungle. So no lion shall be there, nor shall any ravenous beast come up on it. They shall not be found there, but the redeemed will walk there. The ransomed of Yahweh shall return and come to Zion with singing, everlasting joy upon their heads. They shall obtain joy and gladness, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away. And now the last slide takes us, no point of my reading any of it because it's all readable if you want to. Chapter 36 to 39 gives an account, and it's interesting to have it, of the siege of Jerusalem in 701 at the end of the time of Isaiah. And you have to go back to chapter 1 to hear some of Isaiah's comments about it. But if you look through just the headings I've got there, when you read that account, four chapters of it. There's a parallel account in the second book of Kings. This account of the siege puts Hezekiah in a very positive light. And in contrast to the earlier kings, Ahaz was earlier and Zedekiah was later. So Hezekiah was put in very good terms. The relationship between Isaiah and Hezekiah, however, is very different from the impression we get from reading Isaiah's words. And there's a good lesson in that for us. When you read the Bible, it depends on who's writing it, and the truth is probably in the middle somewhere. Some see Hezekiah, and Isaiah himself does in the words. He's criticizing him all the time for his wrong policies and what he's doing. But this is a very positive attitude to Hezekiah, possibly written by the Deuteronomists, another group. But it fills out the story in the Isaiah scroll. The story is closer to legend than history. Version 1 of the threat to Jerusalem and its rescue is given in 36-37. Version 2, they're both there, put side by side, of the threat to Jerusalem is in chapter 38. There's an oracle there concerning Sennacherib, the Assyrian king. Then Jerusalem will survive and Sennacherib will be assassinated, is foretold there or told there. Hezekiah's recovery from mortal illness. He's dying. It's a beautiful thing, really. That chapter 38. And it's also in the book of Kings. So they've obviously taken it from one and put it in the other just to finish up the scroll, finish up the period of the great prophet Isaiah. And there's a Babylonian delegation visits Hezekiah in chapter 39, verse 1 to 8. And so, my dear, patient, lovely people, after 6 weeks, we did an introduction in the first week, and then we've had 5 weeks working our way through the incredibly complex material in the first 39 chapters of Isaiah, which is the only part of the scroll that talks about Isaiah. It's the only part relevant to Isaiah himself. That's Isaiah ben Amoz. And in it, you've got Isaiah's statements, and then you've got later comments coming back, updating them, making them actual for a later generation and written finally in the post-exilic period. Then you've got this bit of history at the end stuck in to finish off the period of Isaiah. So we've now closed that book, really, and we're going to move from chapter 40 to chapter 66. And it's made up of two sections, one written in exile by the school, the Isaiah school, let's call them, and then the other written in the post-exilic period, some of it recalling Isaiah, some of it using him, some of it quoting him even, but not Isaiah himself. And the ones that are quoting him and using him and arranging it are also the ones that went back and organised all that early stuff that they had, scrolls from the actual historical character of Isaiah. So next week we're going to do chapter 40, if you're still here, to chapter 48.